It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod's Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Hello again out there in the KFAR listening audience. I'm Randy Zarnke, and I'll be your host today for another episode of Alaska Tracks, a program where we listen to excerpts from oral history interviews with veteran outdoors men and women from around Alaska. Today's featured guest is Jim Reardon, who I consider to be the greatest outdoor author our state has ever had. Jim wrote several excellent books and countless articles for outdoor magazines. We listened to the first half of Jim's interview last week, and we'll finish up the second half today. Jim's stories are so good, I know you would rather listen to him than listen to me, so let's get started.
I had been writing all these years, weekends and evenings. I built this house by myself, mostly. I've got an office and a dark room, and I was in touch with a lot of magazines. And I'd done a lot of writing for the Alaska Sportsman. It would be the last magazine I'd send an article to because their payment was low. But I'd send it to the top payments and then down the line. And all of a sudden, Bob Henning, the owner, wrote to me and asked if I would do some editing for him. I said, well, yeah. The next thing I knew, a box full of at least 50 manuscripts showed up. He said, accept those that are worth publishing, return all the others. Charge me by the hour, whatever you're worth. Well, that's fine. So I wrote a lot of apologetic letters to people. Some of those things were 3 and 4 years sitting in Bob Henning's office. By the end of 1969, he offered me a full-time salaried job as outdoors editor, which I accepted and kept for 20 years. And those were really interesting years for me in that I could travel around the state. And shortly after I resigned my job with the state, Governor Bill Egan called and asked me if I'd accept a position on the Board of Fish and Game, 1970. Boy, that was a real honor to me. There were 12 members on the board at that time. And the first thing that I accomplished at the first meeting, determine which game management units of the 26 the $50 bounty for wolves would be paid. I argued that bounties were a waste of money, that there was a lot of fraud, that it didn't accomplish anything biologically, that it didn't really control wolves in areas where they needed controlling, and that it was a waste of taxpayers' money. I got 8 votes and forever got rid of the bounty on wolves in Alaska. And one other thing, it took me some years to accomplish this one. Under the territorial days with the federal government, it used to be a requirement that people hunting with airplanes had to have a camp. In other words, you leave Fairbanks, you were flying to a camp, and you'd land and you could hunt. But you weren't allowed to go out and circle around and land and shoot. Well, it was pretty hard to enforce. And under state management, that was dropped. There was no control over it, and there was a lot of aerial hunting. I felt that that was not ethical. It was not respectful of the resource. People didn't appreciate their trophies if they're taking trophies. And I proposed that hunting not be allowed on the same day you're airborne. Well, the first time I proposed it, they laughed at me. The second year, they kind of thought about it. It took me 4 years. And it was passed, and it's still in effect. I think people mostly support it. There's some who don't, but I think it's worked pretty well. One of the directors of the game division, as it was called then, had kind of the same view that I had when I opened the salmon fishery. He said, we're not interested in how they're taken. It's strictly biology. If the resource can stand it, we don't care how they're taken. Methods and means really isn't important to us. take them any way you want, just so we have a sustained yield. And I argued with him. I said, you know, I think that we should consider ethics. Hunting is more than just going out and shooting something. And we should consider that. It just doesn't fit my idea of good game management to ignore the pleasures and the aesthetics, the long history have of respect for the resource. And by golly, we finally got away from his views. Today, I think it's a major part of the consideration that the people have, the boards and the department. When I moved to Homer and the state took over management, we had a heck of a population of moose. The Kenai had peaked. We had cow moose all over the place. And we had antlerless seasons. And boy, we killed a lot of animals. I enjoyed hunting. I've got a son who really loves to hunt. He's now the manager of the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge, Fish and Wildlife Service. He's been with the service now for about 25 years. And I taught him how to hunt. The kids would class, and it'd be their turn to shoot an animal. And we'd slip up on an animal, and they would shoot. And then we would dress them out very carefully, take care of the meat, then retrieve it with the machine. Over the years, I hauled more than 25 moose out of the Caribou Hills with that little machine. And boy, we ate every bit of it. Well, we had 8 kids, and the oldest was gone and married, but there were 6 and 7 kids here in the house that we raised and finally kicked out. So we raised them on moose and caribou and goat and sheep and salmon and halibut. And of course, Mike, my son, who is the refuge manager, living in a house where fisheries management was going on, swore he would never get involved in fisheries management. Now look at him down there in Bethel, the Fish and Wildlife Service. He's right in the middle of it. He has to make the decisions right there in the refuge. And it's tough. He doesn't enjoy it. He says, God, Dad, you went through hell and I'm going through it again. Because it was an extremely demanding job as commercial fishery biologist for Cook Inlet. I flew probably a total of 1,500 hours over the years in Super Cubs mostly, stream surveying. We had a couple of real close ones. One day, the pilot, Johnny Klingbeil, who later became a protection officer with the department, but we chartered his plane at the time, he took off from Homer. And this was early in the 60s, in which we still had stream guards. And we had to take some mail and groceries to the stream guard in Seldovia. So we took off with the Super Cub and flew over, and we intended to go from Seldovia on across the mountains and down into Port Dick and stream survey there and then work on our way around, come back through Bradley Pass, which is at the head of the bay here. And we circled Seldovia Bay. In fact, we came down Seldovia River surveying it and just came into the bay, and he was working the throttle, and the throttle control fell off of the carburetor, and the engine was at an idle. If that had happened anywhere else, we'd have gone into the trees. But as it was, of course, here was a bay right in front of us. He made a landing, and we were sitting there with the engine idling, and he slowly taxied up to the floats at the harbor in Seldovia and called for a mechanic. On another occasion, with a fellow named of Jim Sailing, who was a charter operator and a marvelous pilot. He'd never had an accident in all his years, and he'd flown in the Air Force, and his equipment was first class. Again, we were landing to take groceries and mail to a stream guard, and this was at Port Dick. There's a knob right next to Middle Creek in Port Dick, and it's 300-400 feet high, just right next to the stream. Jim circled, and it was dead calm, started to make a landing, dropped flaps, and we're on floats, of course, and we came down past that knob, and just as we got near that knob, and we were about 50 feet above the water, a downdraft came off of that knob, hit the right wing, and flipped that airplane so that the wings were almost vertical. And, of course, it's lost altitude. I was looking down at the wing and at the water, and sailing, of course, being the wonderful pilot he was, had immediately given full throttle and kicked left rudder and thrown his stick over, and that wing came up and it brushed the water as it came up and level flight. I didn't say a word. Sailing didn't say a word. He went out in the middle of Port Dick and landed, and the stream guard came out with his skiff. But the minute we landed and he shut the engine off, he said, "You will never, never come closer than we just did." One of the hazards in those early years was the state's policy of putting contracts out for the lowest bids, fly with the guy that bid the lowest. Some of the airplanes that showed up here, we would hire a pilot maybe for the summer. One airplane, it was a 180, made one flight with it. We flew it from here to McNeil, straight across. And we got into some turbulence over by McNeil. And when we hit the turbulence, well, that whole cabin would shake and the windshield was loose, like it was going to pop out. And that scared the hell out of us. And then the engine started missing. The engine cut out. And then it picked up again. And boy, we came back here and landed that airplane. We never flew it again. We just let him sit idle. And he finally took it back. And in the meantime, we chartered other people. We finally managed to get a reasonable approach. We had people here that we wanted to fly with who we knew were safe. One guy we flew with was a heck of a good pilot, but he had a little drinking problem. He got the contract one year. I'd flown with him quite a bit, and I liked him. And I told him, I said, "Look, Jay," his name was Jay Carroll. He admitted he had a drinking problem. I said, "Jay, if I smell booze on your breath once this season, whether we're flying or not, if I run into you in town," I said, "that's the end of the contract." He didn't drink a drop, to my knowledge, all summer. He wanted that contract. That New Year's, we were at the Homestead, and it's a restaurant out east. New Year's Eve, we were having a big celebration. Everybody's having fun. Lots of noise. Bill DeCreft, the guy who has Catch My Air Service, plays bagpipes. He came out there and was playing bagpipes. Whoop-de-doo. I sat there, and I was having a drink, and all of a sudden, there's another drink in front of me. Pretty quick, there's another one. Well, I can't keep up with all these, and another one. Finally, Swede Carlson, who was serving these drinks, came up and put another drink. I grabbed him by the arm. I said, "Where the heck are those coming from?" And he pointed across to this Jay. Jay says, "You kept me sober all summer. Now you're going to join me in having some fun."
Geez, that guy led an interesting life, and he can tell a story with the best of them. We have to take a short break for a word from our sponsors. Stick with us, and we'll get back to Jim Reardon after the break. Okay, thanks to our sponsors for their support of Alaska Tracks. Now back to our interview with Jim Reardon.
I've had some interesting magazine assignments. The assignment by Outdoor Life to go into the Brooks Range came out in two parts, and they called it Best Place to Hunt. And it was the first in-depth report ever written about hunting possibilities in the Brooks Range. McNeil used to be part of my area, of course, and at the time that I was flying down there, we had a stream guard down there part of the time. And I'd land and walk over, and we'd look at the bears. And a few people would come down and look at them. A photographer went down there and took a bunch of pictures, sold them to National Geographic, refused to tell them where It was, for the simple reason he didn't want people to go down there. One of the nice things about having taught wildlife at the university and then getting into the field as an outdoors writer and editor at Alaska Magazine is I had good rapport with various biologists, with the federal government and the state. And I encouraged these guys as much as possible to write popular articles based on their research. I remember one in particular, Warren Ballard, and his work with wolves and bears and moose in Unit 13, in which at first it appeared that the wolves were killing most of the moose calves. And as his work progressed, it finally wound up that the bears were actually the major predator, with the wolves as a minor predator. It always struck me as being fantastic, the number of grizzlies that he live captured and transported for 80 to over 100 miles away. And the learning curve on that project was out of this world. You know, the major findings, one, for example, just reinforced what was already pretty well known, is that when bears are moved, they go home. They go right back to where they came from. They've got a compass in their heads that tells them which way to travel, and they do. But the temporary absence of these grizzlies allowed survival of moose calves during that critical period when most of the mortality was taking place. But I had a lot of interesting magazine assignments of my own. One, Bob Henning wanted me to go up on the Yukon Flats and get a story of native hunting muskrats, ratting. He put me in contact with a guy from Fort Yukon, a native, that he had met somewhere. Well, I called the native, and he invited me to his camp up on the Beaver. So I chartered a plane in Fairbanks, flew up to the Beaver to his camp, took a bunch of groceries so I wasn't sponging off of him, took a tent, and camped with him. Well, it was like being in a camp with a Mexican bandit. This was in the spring. There'd be a tree with half a dozen guns leaning, all of them loaded, and every time any animal wandered by, boy, the lead would fly. The day I got there, he'd killed a cow moose. And here I am on the border game, and I'm eating cow moose in this guy's camp up on the Beaver. He'd built one of these canvas ratting canoes. You're probably familiar with them. And I got pictures of him ratting, and his wife was a really nice lady. She was drying the muskrat meat and had a kind of a smokehouse that she was curing them in. She had a bunch of kids. There were six or seven kids, and they were all learning from this guy. This is what you do. Anything that moves, you shoot. He had something like five black bears that he'd killed in a couple of weeks before I got there, and they'd take care of the meat. And the way he took care of the hide, he'd skin them and then wrap the hides around a tree and nail them to the tree and let them cure, which I'd never seen before, which is kind of interesting. He went back to Fairbanks with me when my chartered plane arrived. We got out of the airplane, my car. I said, well, where can I run you? So on the way to where he wanted to go, I said, now, I want to make something very clear to you. I said, I'm a member of the Board of Game. That Indian turned pale, I tell you. I said, but you invited me to your camp. I was there as a writer, but I want you to know I don't approve. You claim to be a conservationist, but you're not. You're not following the laws. You're not teaching those kids the proper way to approach life in the bush. I later was at a meeting that he was at, and he kept eyeballing me, afraid I was going to get up and spill the beans on him. I've done several articles for National Geographic. I wrote one on caribou And that was a real interesting project. Among other things, Bob Stevenson allowed me to use his cabin at Anaktuwik Pass. I flew up there, and Bob Aguk, who was one of Bob's really good friends, an old Eskimo called Arctic John was at the cabin, too, and staying there. Arctic John then lived in Fairbanks, but Hedon was related to these people at Anaktuwik Pass. And he was about 80 at the time, and he'd killed a couple of caribou up in the hills and invited me to go with him, and I walked back with him and listened to him talk, and he was carrying his rifle in a soft case, and he took the case off, and the rifle looked brand new, and he'd had it for something like 20-some-odd years. He took such good care of it, and he had a brass telescope that he used. We walked out of Anaktuwik Pass and climbed up on one of those low ridges, about 3-4 miles away, and sat there. And he told me stories. And he sang for me. He dressed these caribou, and he said it's time for an Eskimo lunch. And he reached down into the gut bile and pulled a kidney out. And he sliced off chunks of kidney and ate them raw. And I took pictures of this. I took the pictures and wrote the article both for National Geographic. I went down to Glen Allen and went out with Loyal Johnson on a helicopter. He was getting reproductive information on caribou in the spring. It was in March. He was getting the numbers of calves compared to cows. That put me into the field doing the things that I really enjoyed doing. Another real adventure, a friend of mine, fellow named of Rick Rosenthal. He's a biologist and a scuba diver and has turned professional and has been doing a lot of filming in the last 15 years. And he had chartered a 60-foot schooner from Hawaii and went to Kiska in the Aleutians. And he had some divers, one of whom had done a lot of work for National Geographic, and he had professional sound people. And he was doing a film. What they had hoped to find was the bottom of Kiska Harbor littered with aircraft and ships from World War II. They're looking for another truck lagoon. It wasn't there. They found a few things. They found a sub and a few ships, few relics, but it was not much. But my fun was, at the time, my wife, Audrey, and I were fishing in Bristol Bay, commercial fishing, set netting, at Dillingham. And I couldn't go down there to Adak, from which he had left. So it was up to me to get to him at Kiska. I told the National Geographic about this guy, and they said, well, it sounds like a good story. We'll assign you to go write the story. And I said, well, how about expenses? Don't worry about it, anything. So I chartered a Grumman Widgeon, and I flew from Naknek to Adak one day, spent the night at Adak, flew from Adak to Kiska the next day, flew down the Alaska Peninsula and hopped, you know, island to island in this Widgeon, which was fantastic. We landed, and Orrin Siebert was the pilot. He owns Peninsula Air now. And we landed. I said, what do I owe you? Can I pay you now, Orrin? No, he says, I'll send you a bill. I said, how much? He said, be by $5,000. And this was 1988, somewhere along in there. Kind of in summary, I've hit the high points. Alaska has been really good to me. I couldn't have chosen a better place to live. The challenges were the kind that I loved. The people and the land have become my people and my land. The professional background I had in wildlife, the self-taught writing, the work with teaching wildlife management and the people I got to work with, the Board of Fish and Game work and the members of the board and the department staff, especially in the early years after statehood, there's a very close feeling and a very high morale at the time. ADF and G people were very close then. In those years, any person of the department who showed up in Homer considered my home his home. There was no such thing as going to a hotel. And the same with me. I'd go to Juneau, and I'd immediately be taken into one of the guys' homes or anywhere else. Kodiak, I'd be in Bob Simon's home and so on down the line. But as the department got bigger and the bureaucracy grew, the departments have kind of become separated. When I was fisheries biologist, I did a lot of scavenging of highway killed moose. I dressed I don't know how many moose. I was alone here. I was the only ADF&G guy around for a long time. And in the middle of the winter, the phone would ring. I'd drive 50 miles up the road to pick up a moose. Thought nothing of it. And it wasn't my job, really. Anyone showed up, why, they would use my equipment. It was a department-wide approach to things. My years with Alaska Magazine. Nowadays, I no longer write magazine articles. I haven't written one for some time. I spend my time writing books. I've written 18, 11 that are currently in print. I'm working on my 19th book now. I have no desire to travel much anymore, although I've been to Africa and New Zealand a couple times to both of them. I'm perfectly content right here at Homer. And I'm very thankful for the life I've had in Alaska.
We've had two great episodes with Jim. I hate to tell you, but that's the end of the interview. But don't despair. Join us again next week when we'll hear from another veteran Alaskan outdoorsman.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod Saw Shop. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.